Okay, here we go. The training world is full of technical editing courses that don't teach the high-end creativity that viewers expect. Inside the Edit was created specifically to teach you every single creative skill you'll ever need to mesmerize your audience. Hello, dear friends, and welcome to episode 13 of Once Upon a Timeline, the official podcast of Inside the Edit. I am your host, Paddy Bird, and I think we've got a really great show for you today. We're going to go to court, and on trial are those sometimes likable, sometimes despised editing companions, the interview transcripts. Do we like them? Are they useful? What is the case for and against? As always, we are going to do a deep dive into this subject and cover a ton of creative editing theory. But before we get going, I just wanted to say what a pleasure it was having Will Znidarek on the show for the last few weeks. If you haven't caught his two-part interview, you really should go back and take a listen, especially if documentary editing is your thing. Both shows are packed to the brim with really useful and inspiring content. And it's so obvious just by listening to him that not only is Will a master editor, but also his theories and thought processes, you know, around his favorite genre of documentary are truly compelling. You can learn a lot by taking on board what he has to say and building it into your own methodology. And to really understand what he's talking about, go and watch some of his documentaries. They're so good and so well constructed. We posted loads of his trailers on the episode 11 and 12 pages at podcast.insidetheedit.com. So do go and give them a watch. And don't forget to keep your questions coming for our Q&A section on Once Upon a Timeline. If you have something you'd like to know, it's pretty much guaranteed that someone else would also want to know the answer too. So let's keep this community alive, keep it buzzing, and keep it thriving. Just email me your question to podcast@insidetheedit.com. So let's get started with this week's creative discussion. On the 28th of December, 1931, a Polish-American scholar named Alfred Korzybski gave a presentation to the American Association for the Advancement of Science in New Orleans. The presentation was called A Non-Aristotelian System and Its Necessity for Rigor in Mathematics and Physics. Yeah, it did sound complicated. But during the presentation, he coined a new phrase which has gone on to become quite famous in many different professions. The map is not the territory. Now, this is a dictum that is not confined to cartography. It's used in everything from philosophy to software development. Korzybski wanted to illustrate that people in general don't really have access to the absolute knowledge of reality, but merely possess a portion of knowledge about reality based on the distorted perception of their own experience. Our map, or our perception of something, is not a true representation of reality or the territory. Okay, we're filmmakers, so let me put it in film language that we can understand. Do you remember Bruce Lee's 1973 martial arts epic, Enter the Dragon? Classic. Well, when training one of his students in the early part of the film, Bruce Lee dispenses some wisdom to his disciple by uttering the immortal Zen Buddhist proverb, "The finger pointing to the moon is not the moon." Don't confuse the description of something for the actual thing. Now, I distinctly remember the circumstances of when I first heard "the map is not the territory." It was a kind of an offhand comment from a director I was working with on one of my first documentaries. I was in my 20s and really excited to have finally arrived in long form. But what she said that day opened up a whole new perspective in editing for me. And to this day, I still find it strange and funny how so many tiny little innocuous moments in life can often trigger, you know, a massive shift in our artistic outlook or abilities. So let me paint the picture. We had got ourselves a fairly respectable rough cut of the scene that we were, you know, putting together. But after watching it through and discussing it, we'd realized that the ending was not nearly as emotional as it needed to be in order to transport the audience into the next few scenes. You know, there was nothing at stake because the interview character didn't come across as though they cared that much about the outcome. And of course, we couldn't have that. If they didn't care, then we didn't care. And if we didn't care, the audience certainly wouldn't care and stop watching. So I'd have to get to work. I needed to go and find some additional interview sync from the character that described their emotional state of mind more forcefully or more overtly than was currently there on the timeline. And so I did as a million editors have done before me to save time. I asked the director if they could remember any specific points or areas within the interview where I might find some more emotional sync. You know, this so often lessens the workload when looking for needles in the haystack like this, especially if the interview is you know, really long. The client, who was more than likely on the shoot, can sometimes remember a part of the raw footage that might be a good place to start looking and therefore narrow down the possibilities and reduce the search time. Every editor wants to save time, or to be more specific, to use whatever time they have in the best way possible. We have a natural aversion and almost allergic reaction to performing jobs in the edit that are open-ended and can suck up time. You know, anything that stands in the way of creating and building and perfecting our timeline in some way often instills a small but perceptible inattention. There's an internal fear that this is not what we should be spending our time doing. With so many different stages in any edit, a pro editor looks at and identifies hundreds of tiny moments throughout any project, no matter what the duration, and attempts to get time wasting, or at least unnecessary work percentages, right down. The equation is simple. The more time we have to craft, the better our film will be. The more time we're doing what is perceived as wasting time or spending an unnecessary amount of time doing things like searching for footage, we're stealing time away from crafting and finessing our sequence. Our edit schedule is finite. Once we've used up that time, that is it. In these early days of rough cutting, a director in the edit suite is often very useful, you know, as a kind of pointer to relevant bits of media. They often know what was shot, you know, on what day and in what order. And if we've got a large amount of media, this can in turn save us a large amount of time. Now, my director racked her brains and pointed in the direction of where there might be some relevant sync. But after playing a few clips in the source monitor, I couldn't find anything that worked. I'm going to go and look at the transcripts, I said, as I took the huge folder and began to leaf through it. Yeah, but we want something emotional, she said back to me. I remember looking back at her blankly, not being sure what she meant. She sensed my confusion and explained further. We want to see and hear emotion. That won't be in the transcripts. The map is not the territory. I remember something clicked inside my head and a whole new vista opened up. I'd never thought about it, you know, in any great detail, but so much of the emotion of a person's delivery was not in the words they said, but in the way they said it. In my early days as an editor, my obsession was largely around building perfect sequences that flowed well visually or obeying continuity, getting the pacing right and you know, choosing the right music. I was kind of on one of the early rungs of the ladder creatively and didn't have the insight into human behavior that is so often needed in the more longer form genres. I was more concerned with style and flow, which is pretty normal at that stage of an editing career. There are always creative jumps and moments of realization in any career as a person matures, and another great piece of the puzzle kind of, you know, fits into place. And this was certainly one of them for me. I'd never heard this fantastic phrase before, the map is not the territory, and I immediately set about researching it and its meaning. It was such a beautiful saying, and even though it obviously had thousands of uses across a wide range of fields, I couldn't help seeing it as a kind of perfect description of the difference between watching interview sync versus reading the transcripts when constructing a scene in a documentary or entertainment show or reality TV show or corporate film, you know, whatever you're cutting. Like anything in creative editing theory, there's usually no simple answer. It's very easy to explain how this button or this particular piece of the interface does this thing if you click it or engage with it in some predetermined way. But therein lies the beauty of this art form of ours. It's a subtle and cloudy set of principles that often overlap and blend into each other. They require us to have a deep understanding of narrative, audience perception, and also human behavior. With modern psychology stating that around 80% of human communication is nonverbal, this opens up an interesting discussion around transcripts and their use in our edits. And our first piece of evidence for the prosecution in the people versus interview transcripts is this. Human behavior is very rarely picked up by a transcriber. The most you'll ever see on a transcript is the occasional cries or coughs added, you know, in parentheses underneath the relevant sync line. But what people say and how they say it are two completely different things. Unless someone is actually saying, I am angry, or this made me angry, or I'm angry because, you know, we so often understand that a character is angry, not by what they are saying, but by the tone, intonation, and inflection of their speech, as well as their body language. You know, we can all recognize the tense and menacing wrinkles on someone's forehead, maybe the pointing of the finger for aggressive emphasis. It could be the rising of the chest to symbolize impending conflict, and the character is making themselves as big as possible. You know, you see this kind of behavior in animals all the time in the wild. And of course, there's a million other subtle behaviors that symbolize just this one human emotion. And added to that, we have dozens of different emotions, both negative and positive, and none of that is picked up in a transcript. Just as complex as body language, the subtlety in human speech delivery has as many shades as the paint fan decks that they give you when you're at your local hardware store, when you're trying to choose the new color to paint your front room. The distance between the words, the loudness or quietness of the delivery, the speed, the tempo in which they speak, and hundreds of other unique characteristics paint that verbal picture for our audience. In the days after hearing that beautiful phrase, I remember turning around in my head the question of whether we actually needed transcripts at all. And like so many people newly exposed to a new film theory or, you know, a new way of thinking, I got radical and kind of purist about it, I'm ashamed to say. You know, we're here to paint human emotion on this screen, and so I shouldn't go by what some transcriber has regurgitated onto some piece of paper. That's soulless. I stupidly went through a phase of deliberately ignoring the transcripts on a new film, just out of this stubborn and pig-headed principle. I became the willing prosecuting attorney in the Editors versus Transcripts court case to anyone who'd listen. Admittedly, not many people did, but that was fine. You know, I discovered a new continent in documentary editing, as far as I was concerned. And, you know, it was up to me to lead the way into uncharted territory. You know, I didn't need a map. Well, this revolutionary gusto, it really didn't last long. You know, over the next few films I worked on, I started to notice something. I was using up a lot of time. After insisting that I watch every single frame of interview and, you know, methodically making notes and subclipping each answer, my finishing time at the end of the day in the early parts of the edit, you know, the rough cut stages, it started to get later and later. This, of course, had a knock-on effect later in the schedule, which is the more traditional time to be working the longer hours. I'd worked a lot more hours than usual, and by the time I needed my brain at full creative capacity to work these longer hours near picture lock, I had already peaked physically and creatively, and it really did show. I painfully realized that interview transcripts were not just there to tell us what everyone said. They were also there to save us time as well and let us quickly piece together a sync construction with the help of just a highlighter pen. But like so many things in this self-taught art form, no one had told me this. No one had actually sat me down and gone through the pros and cons of transcripts. And, you know, this is so common within creative editing. There is an enormous amount of knowledge in our art form, which is just assumed, you know? There are no clear definitions. We're expected to know so many things automatically when cutting a film. And for someone coming in at the start of their career or going into a new genre, I found it just too embarrassing to put my hand up and ask the seasoned directors and producers, you know, around me what was what and what I should do. I was terrified that they'd fire me and I'd never get another chance again. After this revelation, I realized another flaw in my case for the prosecution. I started to look much deeper at interview sync and began to break it down into different classifications. I realized that my assumption that it was all about the emotional sync was just a tiny part of the story. Now, it's rare to have a scene that is 100% high emotional sync. These peak moments are designed at certain points in the film, for any film, for maximum effect. They're part of the gold that keeps the audience watching. Emotional sync is also nothing if it doesn't have context to set it up. And so just like a normal conversation with another human being, there will be a combination of different types of sync. For example, there's descriptive sync, which can outline and describe the point that a character is trying to make. It might mean telling a short story in order to give the audience context or describing the factors at play that caused something to happen. Of course, it could be anything, but it's an archetype. Or there's reflective sync, where a character is often in a deeper level of thought while they're talking and accessing facts or perceptions from their memory. Of course, there's also setup sync, which is often found at the start of a scene and tells us, very often in an unemotional way, where we are and what's going on. I started writing these classifications down and watching sync anew through these lenses. And I also found that I could construct sync pools faster with this way of looking at what people were saying to camera. I'd also watch some of my favorite dramas and documentaries and TV shows and see how other editors would piece these separate sync types together and move seamlessly between one and another. This really helped in the growth of my editing skills. I mean, if I'm honest, writing down anything has always helped me. As a boy, my dad, who's also a writer, amongst many other things, you know, he'd set me writing assignments and give me characters or a premise to work with, Or he'd just say things like, write me a story about X, when I didn't even know what X was. So writing down classifications and subjects, investigating them through words, it's always been a way to find out something for me. It's almost like if I see it on the page and start ordering it and classifying it and breaking it down and deconstructing it, then I can understand it more. I think that was one of the really interesting parts of writing all the scripts for Inside the Edit and piecing them together into like a 100-part series, really. Each tutorial script had a title based on a creative concept that, as far as I was concerned, needed to be understood. But that was pretty much it. I then investigate through writing what were the main components of this particular skill or technique, and then break it down and weave it into a narrative. I guess it's not unlike designing the narrative in a film. So after this analysis of interview sync, after this attempt at classifying the different types of sync and how they weave together, I came to the conclusion that there were so many different types of sync that I didn't actually need to see the body language for or listen to the tone of the voice, you know, anywhere near as when I was hunting for emotional sync. And so I guess you could say I fell back in love with interview transcripts and switched sides. Of course, I told anyone who'd listen about all the essential and amazing uses that transcripts had, and again, very few listened. Luckily, though, I wasn't as blinkered on this side of the fence as I was on the other. It had become blatantly obvious to me through this process that there were times when interview transcripts were incredibly useful, and others when a deep search and extended viewing of the actual clips was much more what was needed. I would need to adapt to each circumstance differently, I told myself. Every film would be different. Every amount of footage would be different. Every interview would be different. No two sets of raw footage are the same. And I wanted to maximize every single moment I had in the edit suite. I would need to move fluidly between the two, training myself to know when to give up on the transcripts and go with the clips and, you know, vice versa. It doesn't matter if we're cutting a 2-minute news report or a 2-hour documentary. We are constantly trying to maximize every moment of our workflow. Quite simply, if we do this, our film gets better and we get employed again because we stand out in the eyes of our clients. The beauty of using transcripts to jumpstart a sync pull and get the bare bones of a scene is incredibly useful in so many different circumstances. All we need is a highlighter pen and to punch in the in and out time codes as quickly as possible. But then there's also going hunting in the raw footage for those moments that we know so often make scenes. The long pause from a character before they answer, the mistake they make when answering, which actually tells us a huge amount about their inner emotional state, or the physical tic or soothing mechanism they display when answering a certain question that will tell the audience so much about how they feel. We love both of these ways of working, and as is so often the case, we need to take several things into consideration when choosing which path. Firstly, how long is the interview? If it's 3 hours, then we probably won't watch all of it. But if it's under 20 minutes, it's probably fine to watch. Secondly, how long have we got to piece this together? We've got lots of pockets of time in any edit schedule, but the client may want to see something in an hour. But then again, they may only want to see something next Thursday. It all depends. And so when the deadline is, should play a major role in our decision making. Ideally, in an editing utopia, we'd watch every single interview, every single shot, every single disc. But that, unfortunately, just does not conform with the reality of most projects. If we're just going for speed, as is so often the case, then transcripts are usually the way to go, as we can read them faster than a character delivers an interview. And of course, all the other delays, like the director pausing in between questions and things like that. How long have we got? How complicated is the work? What's the best plan to produce what's being asked of us in this time? That, my dear friends, is an overarching set of questions that are very applicable to so many stages in editing, but vitally important when we consider using transcripts. You've heard from both the defense and the prosecution in this case, but now it's time for you to judge. I hope you've enjoyed this week's creative discussion. If you have any thoughts or experiences you'd like to share around what we've talked about on today's show, please do drop me an email at podcast@insidetheedit.com. I always love hearing from our community. So, it's time for this week's Q&A. And I thought I'd choose a question that is related to the subject we've been talking about today. Ben in Vancouver, Canada, has asked, what can we do to speed up selection if we don't have the option of interview transcripts? Thanks for sending this in, Ben, and I must admit it's a difficult one to answer without knowing a bit more about the type of edit that we're doing, but I'll give it a go. Yes, it certainly is often the case that we don't have the luxury of transcripts. There are numerous projects that don't have either the time or the budget for transcripts. Lots of online content, for example, like short news documentaries, web-based promos, corporate films, and branded content. These are all genres that probably won't supply transcripts. This is usually due to their short duration of not only the final output duration, which is, you know, usually between 2 and say 10 or 15 minutes, but also the duration of the interviews that were shot. Now, these may be all under, you know, 20 or 30 minutes long and nowhere near the length you'd find in longer form entertainment or documentary. There's also the self-shooting or low-budget documentary. We may be working on a passion project at evenings and weekends with a bunch of friends, and every spare bit of budget has been thrown into the shooting. You know, this is pretty standard, as it's so normal to want to see the money you've spent on the screen. And of course, I've worked in things like daytime TV and low-budget TV for some of the more obscure channels, you know, at the start of my career, where you'd be kind of laughed at if you asked where the interview transcripts were. This is often a classic example of where you see money wasted in post-production. If the production has gone over in their spending, they might be looking to squeeze costs in post so that they can come in on budget. In some production companies and broadcasters, the production managers, whose job it is to control the budget, can get strikes after their name if they overspend. You know, this is a really big no-no in production management. And if you've got too many of those overspends to your name, it creates a bad reputation. And so they may cut down things like the amount of time for the mix or the grade, or shave off half a week in the offline, or of course, not get the transcripts done. Of course, what is not obvious is that an editor's hourly fee is more expensive than a transcriber, and so it's a bit of a false economy. They don't supply us with transcripts, and yet the edit overruns because, you know, we've been spending so many more hours searching for the right sync. But, you know, that's another story. So there's a couple of points I'd like to make, Ben. Firstly, if you really need to break down a large amount of interview sync quickly and you don't have transcripts, then get the person who shot the footage into your edit suite for at least a few hours when you're sync pulling. Try to get the director or producer, but even if that's not possible, try and get the camera operator. We just want to rinse whatever we can out of their recollections about what happened on the shoot. You know, how the character delivered their interview. What were any good bits? At what point in the rushes are the good bits? Did they notice anything negative? Did they evade any questions? Did they cry or get emotional in any way? And when were those great emotional moments? You know, a lot of interesting and useful perceptions can be passed from word of mouth. Just having them point at certain discs or bunches of clips saying, yeah, there were some good answers in this bit, or no, these were all pretty bland, ignore them. You know, that's really helpful and cuts down so much time. If we don't have that ideal time to watch everything and we don't have the budget for transcripts. Secondly, I would also ask to see a copy of the interview questions that were asked by the director. This is really useful as it'll often give us an order and at least a kind of rough heads up to what questions are coming up next. Any pre-known knowledge about the interview is better than nothing. And even though the director often doesn't stick to the order, you know, of the list of questions they wrote down beforehand, it's still good info to have and helps us shape our perception of this character. Finally, and this one is a little bit weird, but I actually was forced to use this technique when cutting the behind-the-scenes VTs on a famous reality TV talent show. We were on location with the band in a big house in the country somewhere, I forget where, and I was cutting the Fallout show on the Sunday morning. So this was everything that happened after the main show had been transmitted live from the studio in London on the Saturday night. We were up against transmission as the show went out at noon, and I had several hours of footage to cut into a 3-minute sequence. But the time I had to cut the sequence was pretty much the same duration of the footage. And so I didn't even have time to watch the interviews in real time. I had to watch the sync and everything else at twice the speed. Now, this high-speed scrubbing of footage, you know, especially with interview sync, if we pay attention, can identify people laughing, people upset, people angry, and a whole list of other traits as well. And like any skill, it takes a bit of getting used to. But the more I watched everything at 50 frames per second, that will be 60 frames for our American cousins, the more I could identify most of what was being said. It sounds crazy, but it did work. It wasn't long before I could shoot around a long clip and quickly listen and pull things down onto a timeline and start constructing. Of course, this requires, you know, really deep focus. And so I recommend doing it with headphones on. You know, people are far less likely to disturb us when we've got headphones on. But if they do start talking to us, it's all over. We have to start again. On some editing software, you can actually set the playback frame rate. So maybe start at 35 frames per second and see how much you can understand. But practice doing it over and over again, and your ear will soon become attuned to it. It was not unlike when I asked my camera operator friend how I should practice focusing when shooting observational and actuality type footage. He said the best way was to go down and stand next to the motorway all day and practice pulling focus on every single number plate as the cars sped by. And don't stop until you can get every single one completely sharp. After you've done that for 2 days, he said, you'll be a master. And this is pretty much the same. But yes, it's a difficult one, Ben. And I would also keep in mind the questions we talked about before to ask ourselves around how much interview sync we've got, what the deadline is, and what the best plan of action is within that time. I hope this answers your question, Ben, and thanks very much for sending it in. Please do keep your questions coming for our Q&A section on the podcast. You can email me directly at podcast@insidetheedit.com, and we'll definitely get your question on a future show. That about wraps it up for another show, dear friends. Don't forget, if you want to learn the actual art of editing and not the same old software theories, come and join us at Inside the Edit. We've helped thousands of filmmakers around the world, as well as many of the industry's biggest broadcasters and production companies, to learn this beautiful art form. We turn you into a powerful, creative editor. I had a real blast choosing the score for this week's episode, courtesy of our friends over at Universal Production Music. I was going for the whole courtroom drama vibe and found these beautiful tracks on Universal's site. If you like the sound of them and you think any of them will suit what you're cutting right now, just head on over to the episode 13 page at podcast.insidetheedit.com. We've got all the tracks listed as usual, with links to the Universal site. Please, please, please don't forget to share this podcast with friends and colleagues. If you're in a filmmaking Facebook group or online editing community, a recommendation from you will really go an extremely long way. And if you have a spare 30 seconds, a review on Apple Podcasts would be really, really appreciated. I'm sure you know how all this works. In order to keep this going, we have to grow the viewing figures and grow the reviews. Take care, my dear friends, and I'll see you very soon on another episode of Once Upon a Timeline. Stay cool, stay safe, stay cutting, and court is adjourned.